Every year, right after Hanukkah, we also have, unfortunately, a sad commemoration, and that is Aseret B'Teves. So that is supposed to be coming up this week, and that's what I'd like to focus on this morning, what exactly the story with Aseret B'Teves is all about. Why is it that we fast? What exactly are we commemorating? And why is this a very important day in the Jewish calendar? So the story begins as follows. After the Churban Bayis Rishon that we'll learn a little bit more about today, the Nevi'im realized that the Jewish community was quickly going to forget about how important and how central it is to have a Beis HaMikdash. And as a result of that, they decided that they had to institute a number of public communal fast days in order that everyone should keep on the forefront of their mind the importance of how much we need a Beis HaMikdash and how colossal the loss of the Churban Beis HaMikdash actually was. And it is on that occasion that they instituted Tisha B'Av, Aseret B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia, and Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Those were the four rabbinic fast days. These are not found in the Torah. These are four rabbinic fast days that were instituted after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, after the first destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So we have a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yud Ches, that discusses many of the issues that pertain to these four public fast days, and we're going to try to go through it as carefully as we can. The Rambam quotes the same thing that the Shulchan Aruch writes, and that we can read together, where the Shulchan Aruch tells us with regard to these four fast days, Chayavim lehisanos, we have an obligation to fast, and here it seems that the Shulchan Aruch does not make a distinction between men and women, between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz. We assume everybody shares the obligation to fast on not only Yom Kippur, but also on the four rabbinic fast days that were instituted to commemorate the Churban. And what are those? So says the Shulchan Aruch, Tisha B'Av, Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, Gimel Tishrei, which is Tzom Gedalia, and Aseret B'Teves. Why do we have an obligation to fast on these days? Mipnei Dvarim Harayim She'iru Bahem, because of the terrible events that took place on each of these respective days. Now the Shulchan Aruch does not elaborate and tell us what exactly did take place on each of these days, and that's why we have to do a little bit of exploring to really understand what exactly we are commemorating and why is it important that we focus on the fast day this week. So we're jumping ahead. Let's first try to focus on in general what exactly took place on Aseret B'Teves, and then we'll see maybe there was something that happened today as well and tomorrow. You're right, you're very correct in pointing that out. So the Mishnah Berurah says that what exactly happened on Aseret B'Teves, what is this fast day all about? Writes the Mishnah Berurah, as we know on Aseret B'Teves, the Nebuchadnezzar Melech Babel, Nebuchadnezzar who was the king of Babylon, decided to lay a siege on Yerushalayim, and that's when everything started going downhill, and from there began the period of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And therefore we have a commemoration to highlight the day, and this very important day, when Yerushalayim went under siege. So let's learn through the Psukim together and try to understand what exactly was taking place. What exactly was the story in the times of the Churban Beis HaMikdash and Nebuchadnezzar? This story really starts with a melech by the name of Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu was a Jewish king, and Tzidkiyahu lived at a time when Nebuchadnezzar was the one who was ruling over many communities. He was the king of Babylon. Now, what we find is that Nebuchadnezzar came and laid a siege on Yerushalayim earlier in history as well. Nebuchadnezzar was a man who was in power and had the ability to destroy the Jewish people way before he decided to do it at the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. I'm going to read here just a little bit from this sefer called Otzer Ishei HaTanach, which is an amazing book. It's written in Hebrew and in English. It's written by Yishai Chasida. I know nothing about him, but I'm sure he was a very great scholar because of the amazing book that he put out. The one in English is also, it's the same, but it's a very good book all about the various personalities in Tanakh and the main sources in Chazal that tell us a glimpse of who they were and what they were all about. So I'm just reading from here just because he summarizes very nicely about the life of Tzidkiyahu. And here he quotes a psikta, one of the Midrashim where we're told that Nebuchadnezzar b'shal shabba Nebuchadnezzar li'galus osam galus rishona. Originally, Nebuchadnezzar had in mind to destroy the Jewish people and send them into exile. He didn't want them in Eretz Yisrael or Yerushalayim. But then, Chazru Rachamav Shel Nebuchadnezzar Aleihem. Nebuchadnezzar had a change of heart, and he decided, as much as he hated the Jewish people, he decided, let me give them another chance. And he didn't want to throw them out at that time. Ana V'yamar, and he said to them, maybe we can find somebody who is able to be the Jewish king over Yerushalayim. Maybe we can find someone who I can trust to be in charge of the Jews, and therefore I would allow the Jews to be kept alive, not to be thrown out of their land. And they went through a whole discussion to try to figure out who it should be. And finally they appoint one king, and then they end up appointing Tzidkiyahu HaMelech as the king of the Jews, who was officially working under Nebuchadnezzar. It was only with Nebuchadnezzar's permission that he was put in charge. And then he says, Hishav ali shelo timor alai. He says, look, I'm happy to give you the job, I'm happy to put you in charge, but you better swear to me that you're not going to rebel. Now that I'm giving you a position of leadership, I never know what you're going to do. So you have to swear to me that you're never going to make a rebellion, and then I will let you have the kingship. And that's what he does. Amar lo Tzidkiyo. Tzidkiyo responds to him and he says, Hareni nishba b'nishmasi. I swear with my soul that I will not rebel against you, Nebuchadnezzar, and I will treat you honorably now that you're giving me this position. Amar lo Nebuchadnezzar, no, that's not good enough. Don't say you swear with your soul. Let's talk tachlis. I know that the most important thing to the Jews is the Torah itself. I want you to take a Sefer Torah and swear with a Sefer Torah in your hands that you are not going to rebel against me, because I mean it. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is warning him. Ma'asa Nebuchadnezzar. So the Medrash says, Hevi Sefer Torah. He brings a Sefer Torah. He nicha al birkav. He puts it on the lap of Tzidkiyahu HaMelech. And vehashbiuhu she'en omarid alav, he makes him swear that he will not rebel against him at any given time. Velo hispak Nebuchadnezzar lelech el arzo, and Nebuchadnezzar didn't even have a chance to get back to regular business. Ad shemarid alav Tzidkiyo, until already Tzidkiyo is starting up trouble, and he's not listening to him, and he's rebelling against him. So the Mefarshim are bothered. How did he go back on his promise? How did he not honor his word? After all, he was holding a Sefer Torah. It's a very important question. But that's really the story that took place. We have another story that the Gemara tells us about Tzidkiyahu and his exchange with Nebuchadnezzar at the time. And again, Tzidkiyahu was the Jewish king, Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. So there we're told, one fine day, Tzidkiyahu bumps into Nebuchadnezzar. And I don't know if it means he came in unannounced, but Nebuchadnezzar certainly was not expecting anyone to be there. So the Gemara says in the Nedarim that Tzidkiyahu finds him, Kisha ochel arneves chaya. What is an arneves? A rabbit? I'm not sure exactly. I think it's a rabbit. So the Gemara says that he sees him. It was disgusting that he takes an animal right off the street and just takes a bite out of a live animal. Doesn't even bother to kill it. It was nauseating. So Tzidkiyahu looks at Nebuchadnezzar and he says, this is beneath a person of your dignity, of your stature, to do something as lowly as that. And he turns to him, he says, Amar lo Nebuchadnezzar. He responds to him, he says, Hishav ali shelo tigala hadavar. I want you to swear to me that you're not going to tell anybody about what you just saw. What I do in my private life is what I do. It's not everybody's business, and I don't want you sharing this information. Nishbalo, and he goes and he swears to him, and then Tzidkiyahu says, why did I swear to him? Such a silly thing. I could go around and tell everybody something humiliating about the great Russian Nebuchadnezzar. Why did I swear to him? And then the Gemara says, Shala chacham vihitiro. He goes and he gets some sort of heter to absolve himself from the shvua that he made, once again, the second time that he chooses not to follow the word that he originally had given. Upirsim adavar, he goes around and tells everybody about what a lowlife Nebuchadnezzar was. After all, I saw the way he acts, I saw what he does, and that's the story that takes place. So, we have this very unusual exchange between Tzidkiyahu and Nebuchadnezzar, where originally Tzidkiyahu was chosen as the one by Nebuchadnezzar himself to be in charge of the Jews in Yerushalayim. And he makes him the melech, he makes him swear that he's not going to rebel, and very soon after that, Nebuchadnezzar realizes that he made a major mistake, and Tzidkiyahu is doing everything that he never imagined somebody would do. Here we are, after Tzidkiyahu is already in his malchus, he's already the king of Yerushalayim for many years, and the pasuk begins as follows. Let's look at the source sheet, and I put it both in Hebrew and in English, just so we can follow along. Vayhi bishnas hachiyas, this is the story as it's told in Sefer Melachim Beis. So the story goes that it is in the ninth year, Lamalcho, the ninth year of whose rule? Rashi writes, we're talking about the ninth year of the rule of Tzidkiyahu. Nebuchadnezzar is the major king. He has this king underneath him, who is Tzidkiyahu. And in the ninth year of Tzidkiyahu's rule, Bachodesh HaAsiri, what is the tenth month? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves. So, here we are in Teves, the tenth month. Be'asor lachodesh, which is Asar b'teves. So this is where the whole story begins. It is in the ninth year of Tzidkiyahu's rule, on the tenth day of the tenth month, Bad Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, realizes that there's this major uprising from the person who he put in charge, And therefore he decides, it's time for me to come and destroy Yerushalayim. It's time for me to destroy the Jewish people. So he comes to Yerushalayim, and he realizes, after he gets there, Hu v'cholchelo al Yerushalayim, after he reaches the destination with all of his army, he realizes that there's a city that is surrounded by a wall, and he has no way of getting in. So he's stuck. He wants to destroy the Jewish people, kick them out of Yerushalayim, but they surrounded themselves, they fortified their city. Vayichan aleha, and therefore he decides to lay a siege around the whole city. This way nobody can go in, nobody can go out. Vayivnu aleha deik saviv, and he builds towers all around the city in order that he should have the ability to at any moment try and wage war against the Jews who were keeping themselves inside of Yerushalayim. Vatavo ha'ir b'matzar, and the city continues in this state of being under siege, Adashtei Esrei Shana LeMelech Tzidkio, until the 11th year of Tzidkio's rule. What does that mean? It means for 2 years, somehow they're living totally self-sustained. The Jewish people do not have anything coming in or going out, because if they would go through the wall, then the soldiers would be able to get through as well from Nebuchadnezzar's army. Here they are sustaining themselves for 2 years, which is an amazing feat for the Jewish people to be able to do that. And the Gemara Maseches Gittin gives us the details of how exactly were they able to take care of that. How did they do such a thing? It was an amazing accomplishment of theirs. But in the end, B'tisha l'chodesh v'yechaza karav v'ir v'lohaya lechem la'ama arz. After 2 years, it comes to a point where you cannot be self-sufficient anymore. After all, there's no wheat growing in Yerushalayim. And how much produce can they have had in the storage houses? How much are they able to take care of themselves? So they get to a point where it was getting to be too much. There was no longer any bread left to take care of the people of the land. The Jews were not able to take care of themselves. And therefore, on that occasion, that is when the city had its walls breached, broken into. All of the Jewish soldiers decided to sneak out. They thought there was a secret getaway where they would be able to hide and they wouldn't be caught. So they secretly snuck out of the city as the walls were being broken. And they tried to go past the army of Nebuchadnezzar, past the army of the Kazdim, and they go to this place, Derech Arava, where they feel that they're going to be able to hide out. So, didn't remain a secret for too long. And now the Kazdim, these soldiers, begin to run after the Melech. Who is the king? Again, we're talking about Tzidkiyahu. He realizes he also has to run for his life, so he tries to sneak out as well. Vayalu oso el Melech Bavel Rivlasa, and they bring him up to the king of Bavel. Vayidabro ito mishpat. And they begin to have a court case. They put him on trial to discuss all that was going on at the time. Now the Medrash fills us in here. Rashi says it on Sefer Malachim as well, that how exactly did they find Tzidkio? You would imagine that the king was probably the one who was able to hide better than anybody else, and he had soldiers who were able to help him. So how could it be that Tzidkio is the one who was caught? So Rashi there tells us in a fascinating story. He says, Ma'ara ha'isa ho'lechas mi beis Tzidkio ha'melech ad arvos Yericho. Tzidkio had the secret tunnel that went from his palace in Yerushalayim all the way to Yericho, which is a great distance. It's a very far distance. And he felt, as long as he goes in the secret path, once he gets out on the side of Yericho, he can run away and hide somewhere, and he has nothing to fear. Baruch Tzidkio derech ha'mara. Once Tzidkio finds out that the siege is now over because the walls of Yerushalayim have been broken into, he quickly goes into the cave, runs away toward Yericho, and he's making his way to try to hide. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Zimein Tzvi Holech Al Gag HaMa'ara Chutz La'ir. For some reason, God had it b'hashkacha that there was a deer who was running right on top of this Ma'ara, right alongside this cave. Radfu HaKazdem Acharei HaTzvi, and all of a sudden the army sees this is a beautiful deer, why don't we go catch it? Doesn't everybody want to have the beautiful head of a deer hanging in their home? So the soldiers get distracted from everything going on. They decide, let's go run after the deer. The deer, meanwhile, is running alongside this secret tunnel. They don't know what's going on underneath. And finally, they get to catch up with the deer. Mishihigia lepesach ha-ma'ar ba'arvas Yericho. Now, all of a sudden, Tzidkio runs out of the cave, and he thinks he's safe. And there they are, standing with the deer that they just caught. And that's how Tzidkio's life came to an end, which is a very amazing story. And what you see from it is that as much as a person can hide and as much as a person might want to run, when it's time, it is time. And that's what the that's what we're told over here, that Tzidkiyahu HaMelech unfortunately lost his life, ultimately, as we'll see in the Psukim in a minute. But we should not think that Tzidkiyahu was such a simple person. Tzidkiyahu, as we said, had a very complicated legacy. The Midrashim tell us a lot about him. But the Gemara says that Tzidkiyahu was created when he was born. He had something very special about him. The Gemara says, Chamisha nivru me'ein dugma shamayla. What exactly that means, I don't fully understand, but it says that there were five individuals who were born, me'ein dugma shamayla. They had something that was almost a replica of God himself. Who were those five people? It says that Shimshon was created with unusual amount of strength, as we know the Navi tells us, Shimshon ha-gibar, and Shimshon had a strength that was a heavenly kind of strength. Shaul b'tzavaro, Shaul had a neck that was amazing. I don't know exactly what that means either. Avshalom b'saro, Avshalom was so beautiful, the hair that he had was so beautiful looking. And finally it says Tzidkiyahu be'enav. Tzidkiyahu had eyes that were such pure eyes, such beautiful eyes, it looked like God himself. And that's what the Gemara tells us. V'kulam laku, and the final one was Asa Baragla. We're told Asa had this amazing leg, something like that. But whatever it is, the Gemara tells us that all five of them were created with this unusual characteristic, something that was almost godly, and they all came to their downfall as a result of this great gift that they were given, which is another important lesson that one has to be very careful when we are given certain gifts in our own lives, which are clearly heavenly gifts. We have to make sure to use them for the right purposes and not to fall into the trap of that gift itself being what leads perhaps to a person's downfall. So here Tzidkiyahu HaMelech is caught. And as we are told, they bring him to a trial. V'ezbenei Tzidkiyahu shachtu le'enav. So there he is, Tzidkiyahu is waiting on trial. They bring in all of his children that they caught as well, and they murder all of his kids right in front of his eyes. V'ezenei Tzidkiyahu iver. As if that wasn't bad enough, now they decide to blind Tzidkiyahu HaMelech as well. V'yasreel ben achashtayim v'yivyehu bavel. And they put him into a chained vehicle, whatever it was, and they bring him down to Bavel. Uvachodesh hachamishi b'shiv alachodesh. On the seventh day of the fifth month, what is the fifth month? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av. Right? On the seventh day of Av. Hishnas tishas reishana lemelech Nebuchadnezzar belech Bavel. This is the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar being in charge. That's when he sends one of his viceroys by the name of Nebuzaradan, Rabba Tabachim. He was known as the great butcher, Nebuzaradan, which tells you a little bit about what kind of person he was. And he sends him to go to Yerushalayim. All right, that's it. Time to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. And that's how the story of Tisha B'Av plays out, because that's when Nebuzaradan was sent to really destroy. By Yisrov is Beis Hashem, Bez Beis HaMelech. Nebuzaradan does his job faithfully, and he goes and he destroys the Beis HaMikdash. Ves kol bati Yerushalayim. He destroys everything that was happening in Yerushalayim as well. Ves kol bayis hagadol saraf ba'esh. He destroys everything, burns it down to the ground. There is nothing left. He knocks down the walls of Yerushalayim. And everything that we once knew about the amazing place called Yerushalayim is now destroyed. Now that all began, as we saw, on Asar B'Tevis. It culminated in the story on Tisha B'Av, when the Beis HaMikdash was actually destroyed, but it all began with the siege on Asar B'Tevis. And the question that the Chasam Sofer asks is, why do we commemorate the siege around Yerushalayim? After all, that was not really the end of the story. That was just the beginning. So why is it something that we commemorate? We should just have a commemoration of Tisha B'Av. So the Chasam Sofer also points us to the fact that over the generations, there were many others who came and laid siege around Yerushalayim as well. For those who are avid Navi readers, Tanakh learners, so you'll go through Tanakh and you'll find there were many others who came and tried to destroy Yerushalayim as well. Why don't we have any commemoration for that? Writes the Chasam Sofer very simply, because this really was the beginning of the end. This really was the beginning of the end. And yes, it's true, Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people in Yerushalayim, suffered on many occasions throughout their time being in Yerushalayim. But this was really the beginning of the end. And I saw the Pasuk writes in Sefer Koheles, if you look at the end of your sheet, we find the Pasuk says, Ki lo yeda ha'adam es ito. Unfortunately, a person never really knows their time. And we know that to be true. We know that life can end at a moment's notice, or life can be given at a moment's notice. One never knows what is going to be the right time. Kedagim shene'achazim b'mitzudara, like fish who are caught in a trap. Now, what exactly does that mean? Rabbi Elia Lapian wonders, what does it mean when we make an analogy between the end of life and a fish who is caught in a net. What is the intent of the pasuk there? Suggests Rabbi Yelapian very simply that he says when you have a fish that is taken out of the water, the fish starts flapping and it's all agitated over the fact that it lost its life now that you've taken it away from the water source, which is the only way it can sustain life. But the fish doesn't realize that its life was over hours ago when the fisherman came and got it in the trap. Its life was already over then. Happens to be the manifestation of the end of life is when we pluck the fish out of the water. But the end came about much earlier on. When the fishermen were out at sea and caught this fish, its life was already over then. And therefore, writes Rabbi Lapian, that's really what we commemorate on Aseret B'Teves as well. Yes, when the fish is actually plucked out of the water, when the Beis Hamikdash is actually burnt to the ground and destroyed, and all the kelim are stolen, and that's the end of the Jewish community in Yerushalayim, obviously that is the end. But the end came about way before. Once the trap was laid around Yerushalayim, that was really when we knew that all of it was going to be over, and from that time on, everything started to go downhill. There is a pasuk in Sefer Yecheskel, where Yecheskel is told b'nevuah that this is going to happen as well. So if you look on the second side of your sheet, number Gimel, there the Navi Yecheskel, who lived at the same time, at the end of the period of the first Beis HaMikdash, the Navi Yecheskel has a nevuah, Vayhi Dvar Hashem Elai Bashana HaTashiyis. Yecheskel has a nevuah in the ninth year of, once again, that is the ninth year of Tzidkiyahu's rule. What is that? That's a familiar date. That is on Aseret B'Teves. The very same Aseret B'Teves when Nebuchadnezzar came and laid siege around Yerushalayim, Yecheskel is subsequently having a nevuah as well somewhere else about the fact that something big is taking place today, and God tells him in a dream, I want you to be aware that there is a siege being laid on Yerushalayim. And God says the following, Ben Adam. Now, why does he refer to Yecheskel as Ben Adam? We are all human beings. We are all Ben Adam. Why is Yecheskel singled out as Ben Adam? So a number of years ago, I saw a pasuk that said, referred to Yecheskel as Ben Adam. I didn't really understand why he's referred to as such. And I looked in the Mefarshim in Sefer Yecheskel where they explain as follows. There are a number of interpretations, but I believe Rashi says the most simple pshat, and that is, people were so enamored by Yecheskel's personality, and they were so overwhelmed by his great Kedusha that he had, they said, there's no way this man is a human being. And therefore, God refers to him and he says, no, Ben Adam, you were born as a human being, you were born to two parents, and that is the way you came about into this world, and nobody should mistake you for being a Malach, you are a Ben Adam. Which comes to teach us, says Rashi, that every human being has the capacity and has the ability to rise above the regular lifestyle of a regular human being that is born into this world and can become something that might be mistaken with a Malach. That was the greatness of Yecheskel HaNavi. As we know, Yecheskel had the great visions of the Maisar Merkava, but he grew himself, he developed himself to become this person that people ultimately almost made a mistake that perhaps he wasn't even a human being. That's how great he became. So he's told in this Nevuah, Ksav Lecha Eshem Hayom, God tells him, I want you to write down what the date is today, as Etzem Hayom Hazeh, Samach Melech Bavel El Yerushalayim Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh. I want you to write down in your notes that today, on Aseret B'Teves, is the day that Nebuchadnezzar laid a siege on Yerushalayim, and this is the beginning of the end. So we have, both in Sefer Melachim, as well as the Navi Yecheskel, tell us the same story, and this is what happened. So we have the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and then there was a prophecy before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Yirmiyah HaNavi, who also lived at the time, gave over a prophecy to the Jewish people that there's going to come a terrible time, terrible destruction. However, Yifkod Hashem, God is going to remember all of you, and He's going to bring you back to Yerushalayim. And it's only going to be 70 years until you have the opportunity to build yet a second Beis HaMikdash. And that, in fact, is what happened. Yirmiyah has that benevuah. He tells it over to the Jewish people. And after 50 years of being sent into Galus Bavel, the Jewish people are then returning back to Yerushalayim. Who was leading the charge at the time? Ezra, right? So the Gemara tells us Ezra HaSofer was one of the great and towering figures of that generation. We know the last three Nevi'im that lived were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. They were the last three Nevi'im that ever gave over prophecy to the Jewish people. And the Gemara in Maseches Megillah tells us that you'll notice when you learn through Navi, one will notice that very often you have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi who are all clearly friends with each other, but whenever Ezra HaSofer has a conversation with them, he refers only to Haggai and Zechariah, but he doesn't refer to Malachi. And the Gemara wonders, why is it? Why is he leaving out the third friend? How come he's only referring to Chagai Zechariah? What about Malachi? And the Gemara answers, because Ezra's other name was Malachi. So he's referring to his two other friends, but he was one of those three great Nevi'im in the last Tzkufa of Nevi'im. Ezra was Malachi, and that is the three Nevi'im, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, who lived at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. They come back to Yerushalayim. Ezra tries to encourage the Jews to return back, and he says, now is the time. We saw the Nevuah, Yirmiyah Navi told us 70 years, that's all, we're going to be in exile, now it's time to go back. And the Navi tells us how very few Jews chose to come back with him. Same story that we have today. Right? The amount of Jews that are coming back to Yerushalayim and to Eretz Yisrael is not the amount that it should be. We're blessed that we have many, but unfortunately many of us are committing the crime of not going back as we should. And the Navi screams at us and says, God allows you to go back. How do you stay behind? How do you not listen to the call? How do you not understand the message? And that is, Ezra HaSofer is really responsible for bringing back the Jews to build the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, we're faced with a problem. Because after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, that's when the Chachamim institute these 4 days of commemoration. Tisha B'Av, and Asara B'Teves, and Shabbat Asar B'Tammuz, and Tzom Gedaliah. All of those were events that took place in the first Beis HaMikdash. And once it was destroyed, we wanted people to remember the great destruction. But now we have a Beis HaMikdash again. 70 years later, after they observe these public fast days, now we have a Beis HaMikdash that is rebuilt. And we can give thanks to Ezra HaSofer. And the question now is, well, what do we do with those 4 public fast days? Why should we commemorate a great tragedy when, after all, now we're back into the Beis HaMikdash again? Now, once again, when the Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, it was not close to as glamorous the second time as it was the first time. It wasn't until Herod came along much later on and he beautified the Beis HaMikdash and he gave a major upgrade and he decided to build it the beautiful way that he did. But when Ezra HaSofer came back with a limited number of Jews, they were not able to afford to build the Beis HaMikdash the way it once was built. And we are told in Navi that on that occasion, there were many Jews who were still alive who remembered what life was like back in the first Beis HaMikdash. And although the younger generation was celebrating over the fact that now they have the opportunity to have a Beis HaMikdash, the older generation were crying. They said, this is very nice, but this is nothing like what we remember. This is not as glorious as the Beis HaMikdash once was. So there were mixed emotions at the time. On the one hand, they had a Beis HaMikdash again. On the other hand, it wasn't close to the experience that they once had had by the Bayis Rishon. And this is really what's going on. And the question presents itself, well, bottom line is, we're excited over the fact that we have a Beis HaMikdash. So do we continue to commemorate the destruction of the first, or do we just forget about it? This question was posed to Zechariah HaNavi. Zechariah was living at the time, and they asked him, what should be the Jewish communal response right now? Should we continue to observe these 4 public fast days in commemoration for the tragedy of the first Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, or should we just move on with life? Now we have a second Beis HaMikdash, and we're going to be in this for hundreds of years. As we know, the second Beis HaMikdash lasted for 420 years, which was more than the first Beis HaMikdash lasted. And the question was, what do we do about the public fast day? So Zechariah HaNavi gives the following answer. If you look at number Dalid, Zechariah gives a very convoluted answer, and the Gemara Maseches Rosh Hashanah works very hard to try to decipher what exactly the answer is. So Zechariah HaNavi tells them as follows. Karmar Hashem Tzivakos. He says, you asked me the question, and here is the answer. Tzom HaRavi. What is the Tzom HaRavi? Why is it Shavasar B'Tammuz? Because we have Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz. So he says, the fast day of Shavasar B'Tammuz. Vitzom HaChamishi is Tisha B'Av. Vitzom HaShvi'i, which is the 7th month, which is Tzom Gedaliah. And finally, Vitzom HaAsiri, which is Asara B'Teves. All of those 4 public fast days that we instituted on the occasion of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, Yiyeh LeBeis Yehuda LeSasson LeSimcha LeMa'adim Tovim, from here on in, everybody should celebrate, everybody should rejoice. No more looking back at the first Beis HaMikdash, time to move on with life. Now that we're back in Yerushalayim, just forget about it. That's what Zechariah HaNavi told the Jews at that time. No reason to have any more commemoration. And that's the way it was done. For 420 years, throughout the duration of the period of the Bayis Sheni, there was no commemoration at all for the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, because that was the instruction of Zechariah HaNavi. Now we're faced with another problem. What's the problem? Now the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. And now that we have the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, we once again have a question. Do we go back to the original? Do we now revert back to the old story and start to commemorate those four fast days? Or do we already get rid of those and now all we have to commemorate is Tisha B'Av because both the first and the second Beis HaMikdash were destroyed on Tisha B'Av? Now the problem is, as we mentioned, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi are the last three Nevi'im. Now that the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, who are we going to ask the question to? We don't have any Nevi'im any longer. So what do we do? And the Gemara goes into a major discussion about what exactly is supposed to be the communal response now that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And the Gemara tells us the rule goes as follows. There are three time periods in which one has to consider this question. Says the Gemara, when you have a Beis HaMikdash, Zechariah HaNavi already answered the question. No reason to have any days of mourning. When you have a Beis HaMikdash and Jews are enjoying their experience in Yerushalayim, then he says this is a day of Sasan v'Simcha, this is a day of celebration. When you don't have a Beis HaMikdash and the Jewish people are in Galus and being persecuted, then we have to observe these public fast days because we're still in a state of mourning. So that's the second time period that the Gemara describes. When you have no Beis HaMikdash, plus the Jewish people are in Galus and they're being persecuted, in a case like that, says the Gemara, you have to revert back to the old story of all four of these public fastings. What about a generation like ours, says the Gemara, where we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, that's a Areinu HaRav, but at the same time, we're not really being persecuted. Yes, there is global anti-Semitism, we know it's true, but for the most part, the Jews are living very wonderful lives these days. So what is the status of these four public fast days when we have a generation where we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so we're missing the most important central focus of our lives, but at the same time we're not really being persecuted. We're not in a Shas HaShmad. So how would we react in a generation like that? And the answer the Gemara gives is, in generations like ours, Ratzu Mis'anim, Ratzu E Mis'anim. It's up to every generation to decide. Is this something we should do or not? Now the Rishonim already say that in their days they have decided for all eternity that this is the way it's going to be until the next Beis HaMikdash. We are going to observe these four public fast days. But the Gemara assumes that this is really something that is up to every generation to decide whether or not they should be observing these days of mourning or perhaps not. And that is where we leave ourselves today. What difference does it make that today these fast days are not really considered to be as obligatory as they once were? That makes a major difference. And the difference is as follows. In the 70 years between the first and second Beis HaMikdash, as we mentioned, those four public fast days were observed by everybody. And when they originally instituted those public fast days, the Gemara says, those were instituted as real fast days like Yom Kippur. So everybody had to fast, number one, 25 hours from sundown to sundown. Not only on Yom Kippur, but also on Tisha B'Av, on Shavuos HaBetamuz, on some Gedalia, and on Aseret B'Teves. Everybody fasted from one night till the next night, which makes a lot of sense. That's what a Jewish day actually is. Not only that, the Gemara says, we assume that on those public fast days, everybody had the same restrictions that apply on Yom Kippur as well. So not only do we refrain from eating and drinking, but we also didn't wear leather shoes. We also had all the restrictions that applied, no bathing, no showering. All of that applied equally to Tisha B'Av and Aser B'Teves and Tzom Gedalia and Shavuos HaBetamuz as it did on Yom HaKippurim, because the Chachamim patterned these public fast days off of the one that we find in the Chumash. And that is the way it was. But now, says the Gemara, after the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and there was a major question as to what is the status of these four public fast days, so now we assume that the status is going to change. Even though we have accepted upon ourselves that we're going to fast on these fast days, maybe the rules are not going to be as strict as they were back in the times when there was Churban and Shmad, and when the generation of Jews was living through terrible persecution. So let's just for argument's sake, there were those who argued that during the days of the Holocaust, let's say, when it was clear that we didn't have a Beis HaMikdash, and we also were going through the most horrible period that the Jewish people have ever suffered, maybe then these four public fast days would be absolutely obligatory. And then we should go back to the old rules, which are, we should fast 25 hours, nobody's allowed to shower on these public fast days either, and all the rules of Yom Kippur apply equally to these public fast days. We are very blessed that today we don't have that. And that is not the question that we are faced with. But as a consequence of the fact that these public fast days are not as obligatory as we assume, therefore the rules have changed drastically. So no longer do we fast from night, from sundown to sundown. No longer do we assume that there's a restriction against a person taking a bath or a shower on these public fast days. The only one that kept the old rules is Tisha B'Av. Why is that? Because Tisha B'Av is Tisha B'Av. That is the day when both of the Beis HaMikdash were both destroyed. And therefore Tisha B'Av remains with the original rules. But the other three, we assume, get bumped down a notch. And that is why we have many, many leniencies when it comes to Asar B'Teves, when it comes to Tzom Gedalia, as well as when it comes to Shiva Asar B'Tamas. Now that does not mean that anybody who is hungry has the right to eat. You know, almost every fast day I get a phone call from someone who says, Rabbi, I'm really hungry, can I eat? No. A public fast day is that you're supposed to be hungry. That's what it means. So if you're not feeling well, it's a different question. And obviously if one is not feeling well, we're going to measure it differently when it comes to Shiva Asar B'Tamas and Asar B'Teves versus Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. Why? Because as we mentioned, these public fast days are not as obligatory as they once were. And therefore we have far more of a lenient tilt when we come to cholim, to people who aren't well, with regard to Asar B'Teves, than we would when it comes to Tisha B'Av. Off the bat, the Shulchan Aruch says that mu'ubarus u'meinikos, women who are pregnant or who are nursing, certainly have an obligation to fast on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av as well, unless there's a health concern there, which many doctors have said there is none. Some doctors say there is. So you have to ask your own doctor, who you trust, I don't know. But there is a major question about whether or not it's healthy for a woman who is pregnant or nursing to fast. And generally we assume that on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, a woman who is pregnant or nursing should do her best to fast. However, off the bat, the Shulchan Aruch says, when it comes to these three other fast days, a pregnant or nursing woman do not have an obligation to fast. Why is that? Says the Shulchan Aruch, because at the time that we accepted upon ourselves to have these public fast days, and they weren't completely obligatory, we never accepted it with all the restrictions, and we didn't accept it universally. We said, we're going to accept it for those who can handle the fast day. But for those off the bat who are weaker, for women who are pregnant and who are nursing, says the Shulchan Aruch, there was never an acceptance for them at all on these public fast days. Again, that doesn't mean that somebody who has a headache or somebody who just is hungry has the right not to fast on Asar B'Teves. We are supposed to fast on Asar B'Teves, but obviously there is far more leniency than there would be on one of the other major public fast days, such as Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av. A very important question that is asked, or that should be asked more often, is what about a person, and certainly now when we have the sun only rises at 6:30 in the morning or something like that, 6:45, can I wake up early in the morning and eat before the fast begins? Which is very easy for us to do today, because it's not like you have to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. All you have to do is wake up at 5:15 and you can have a nice breakfast and then you'll be good for the fast. So this is a question that was raised in the Gemara Maseches Tainis Daf Yud Beis. And the Gemara wonders, does a person have a right to wake up in the morning and eat before the fast or not? So the Gemara says, well, the truth is that ostensibly the fast is really officially supposed to begin at night. The original rule is that the fast begins at night. Now, we have not accepted that today, because we're not observing the fast the way it originally was instituted, and therefore we start from the morning. However, says the Gemara, once a person goes to sleep at night, the assumption is that you have accepted upon yourself the fast. And now, no more eating, no more drinking. That's what the Gemara assumes. However, says the Gemara, if a person, the Yerushalmi writes this, if a person stipulates before they go to sleep that they plan to wake up in the morning and eat before. Now, stipulate does not mean, my father has told me that stipulate does not mean you have to say it expressly, but if you have in mind before you go to sleep that I plan to wake up in the morning and have something to eat, so then the Gemara says, obviously, the fast for you does not begin until after you wake up and have your breakfast. Now, one has to be careful to know the proper zman and to know that you are not breaking the fast early in the morning. Sometimes when you think it's not yet morning, it might already be. So you have to look very carefully what time the fast actually starts and when the last time to eat is. But if you plan, if you have an intention of eating in the morning, then one has to have that in mind before they go to sleep the night before. What about when it comes to drinking? So here, the Ramah writes, since most people, when they wake up in the morning, have a drink of water or a cup of coffee or something in the morning, that is the natural response of everybody when they wake up in the morning, therefore, says the Ramah, it's almost implicit that when I go to sleep at night, I had in mind that when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to have a coffee. And therefore, he says, you don't even have to have in mind to have the drink in the morning. Now, the Achronim say, it depends what kind of person you are. Look, personally, I don't drink coffee. I've never tasted a coffee in my life. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm still awake. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm afraid to. I think I would be too awake. And when I wake up in the morning, all I do is brush my teeth, play with my kids, and I go to shul. I don't take a drink in the morning. So for me, the Achronim say, maybe the calculation would be different. But for most normal people, I guess, who do drink a coffee in the morning and who do have something to drink before they go out to do whatever they're doing, the Rama writes, there really might not be an obligation for a person to specifically have any stipulation before the fast that they plan to drink in the morning. When it comes to eating, one certainly should. So says the Mishnah Berurah, if it's not so difficult, so you should make the stipulation either way. For eating, for drinking, this way you're covered, and this way you don't have to worry about it. But officially, this is why one has to think about it from the night before. There was also a discussion. Let's say Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik had a disagreement about what is our perspective about the night of the fast. Now, we know we don't begin the fast at night. Obviously, we eat dinner at night, and we don't already start Asar B'Teves at night. But let's say when it comes to Shavuos B'Tammuz, and that is the onset of the 3 weeks. So do we assume that the 3 weeks begin already at night? Or do we assume they only begin in the morning? And that is a very important question, because very often people want to make weddings in the summer, and you're limited the amount of days that you can do. People are going away, and it's not so easy to find a hall on a date. And there are people who want to make weddings on the night of Shavuos B'Tammuz. So are you allowed to have such an occasion, such an affair? Are you allowed to have music? Do the 3 weeks already begin at night? Because after all, the time is really supposed to begin at night, just we lift some of the restrictions, but maybe we shouldn't go out of our way to make a wedding then. There was somebody who asked me that something came up this year, and they had an issue scheduling the wedding. And for whatever reason, they had a date, and then the date was changed. And they wanted to know, the hall now was very last minute. I think the hall overbooked something. It was a horrible story. The hall overbooked two weddings. And realized about 3 or 4 weeks ago that they had overbooked. And this guy called me up and said, what does he do now? The only night that they have available is the night of Asar B'Teves. Because nobody wanted to schedule a wedding the night of Asar B'Teves. But that's the only hall that he can get in the next near future. And he said his children were already excited to get married in the next couple of weeks. And now he's going to have to wait another couple of months if he can't get the hall on the night of Asar B'Teves. And he asked me what he should do. So I wasn't sure what to say. I asked my father, and my father said, well, it depends. If he's in every other area of his life, if he follows Rav Soloveitchik's opinion, then he should follow it here as well. And Rav Soloveitchik was of the opinion that it is not appropriate the night of a Tainus to have celebrations, because he felt the night of a Tainus already, officially the Tainus already begins. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that, no, if we assume all of the restrictions are lifted until the morning, that means that the night does not have the status of the fast at all. And therefore, Rav Moshe was of the opinion that if need be, you can have a wedding even the night of a Tainus. And that's what I told this person. If his family generally always follows Rav Soloveitchik, which they don't, then he should follow him. But if not, he can follow the mainstream psak that I think most people follow, which is the opinion, the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein, that you can have the wedding and you don't have to be concerned, because the night of the fast is really not considered the fast itself. Often over the course of a fast day, a rabbi will be presented with the following question, and that is, Rabbi, I made a mistake, I ate something, I didn't realize that I was fasting, somebody is cooking dinner for that night, and they just taste it, and they don't realize. I remember I had a caterer who called me, that he was asked to cater a bris. The bris was in the morning, but the meal was going to be at night, that was going to be the breakfast. And as he was working in his commissary, he mistakenly took some of the food to taste it, to make sure it was coming out good, which I said, the Bali Simcha will be happy that it's fresh food. But he wanted to know, can I assume that now the fast is over? Or should I assume that I have to continue and just ignore what took place? So the Shulchan Aruch discusses this. And the Shulchan Aruch writes that even if a person eats a considerable amount of food in the middle of a fast day by mistake, they should still continue to fast. If you made a mistake, it doesn't mean you should continue to make a mistake. We should correct the mistake by just continuing out the day and not breaking the fast. Now the Shulchan Aruch gets into a discussion. Do you have to do a makeup day? Because you made a mistake, but does that mean you have to make a makeup? And the Shulchan Aruch writes, not really, because there's a reason why Asar B'Teves was chosen. There's a significance to the day. What's it going to help if 3 weeks later you're going to arbitrarily choose a day that works for you to fast, you know, when you have off from work or whatever it might be? That's not something that has any significance. And therefore, writes the Shulchan Aruch, there would really be no no significance to a person having a makeup date a few weeks later. So the Mishnah Berurah says, yes, there are some who still have to practice to make a makeup, and he says, maybe it's better if you give tzedakah instead. Whatever it is, you figure out what to do. But generally, the question that is asked is, if a person makes a mistake, Shulchan Aruch says you should continue to fast. Very often there's a question also, and that is, what if a person not only makes a mistake about eating, you didn't make a mistake about eating, but rather, you make a bracha on a drink, Shakol Niyabedvar, then you realize right before you drink, I forgot all about it, it's a fast day. On the one hand, it's a bracha levatela. How can I leave the bracha hanging? How can I not take a drink? On the other hand, how could I take a drink? It's a public fast day. So this is a major question that is discussed in the Achronim. It is something that they mention as well with regard to, let's say, the 9 days. Somebody picks up, you know, you serve dinner and everybody makes a bracha on the steak that you're serving, and then you realize it's the 9 days, we're not allowed to have meat. So do you take one bite of the meat in order that it shouldn't be a bracha levatela and then put it away? Or should you just ignore the bracha levatela? It's a major question that comes up. Let's say, probably more often, more common is if a person, I know this happens in Eretz Yisrael often, because there they have fleishiks for lunch. In America, generally, we don't do that, but there, they have fleishiks for lunch. So very often when you have Americans who are visiting, they don't remember that they had fleishiks for lunch, and then they want to have a coffee later on, they make the bracha shahakal, and they say to themselves, I can't believe I just made a bracha, I am within the 6 hours of when I ate meat. So all of these questions are raised by the Achronim. A person should try and be careful not to get themselves involved in this predicament, because it's a major, major question what exactly to do. We know that on the public fast days, not only are we supposed to be fasting, not eating and not drinking, but also the Chachamim instituted that one is supposed to recite Anenu. One is supposed to recite an extra paragraph in Shmona Esrei. There are some Rishonim who said that should already be recited at night in Ma'ariv. Why? Because the public fast day officially begins already at night. It happens to be we lifted the restrictions of eating and drinking. We're allowed to eat and drink at night and take showers and do everything else. But generally they say really the day of commemoration begins at night. And therefore the Rishonim said there were those who felt it's appropriate already to say Anenu at night. That is not the accepted opinion. We only as individuals recite Anenu in Mincha of a public fast day. And this applies whether you're davening in shul or at home. You should be reciting Anenu by mincha on a public fast day. Why do we only recite it in mincha? Why don't we say it in shachris as well? We're all fasting in the morning. Why don't we say it in shachris as well? So Rashi explains the reason why is because we don't want someone to be nira kimishaker. Sometimes you start off a fast day, you're feeling fine, but as the day progresses, you have to break it because you don't feel that at all. So he says, how can you say in your davening, Anenu Hashem, answer us, B'yom Tzom Taniseinu. This is the day that we have designated as a public fast day. I don't know if I'm going to make it through. However, Rashi writes, once you get to Mincha time, if you're still fasting, we assume you're probably just going to do whatever you can to make it through the rest of the day. And therefore, that's why we have adopted the custom that only by Mincha, Anenu is recited, but it is not recited either by Shachris, nor is it recited by Ma'ariv the night before. As you very correctly mentioned, yeah?
Mm-hmm. On the night. Mm-hmm. What about the guests who don't feel that that's appropriate, or it's not their mitzvah to do it?
That's a very, very good question. Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about that with regard to Svira. So we have two different minhagim when people observe the Avelis of Svira. Some people do one half, some people do the other. And Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses, so what do I do if I live in a community where one of my friends is making a wedding when I am observing Avelis? And he says there's no reason that the Chasan and Kala should be punished by your not being there. If that's the psak that they got, and that's the halacha that they're following, and it's a very legitimate one, Rav Moshe writes that they certainly should be given the respect that they deserve, and all of us as a community, even though it's breaking our norm of observing Avelis, we are supposed to participate in the wedding regardless. Now, it doesn't mean that you should go searching around for weddings to go to in order that you should have a great time. It means if you are an invited guest and you're somebody who belongs at the wedding, you should go. And that's what Rav Moshe feels. I would assume he would say the same thing over here as well. As you very correctly mentioned in the beginning of this year, Asar B'Teves is something that we commemorate the Churban Beis Hamikdash. But the Shulchan Aruch informs us that there is added meaning to this time of year as well, because there is significance not only to Asar B'Teves, but also the 8th of Teves, the 9th of Teves, also were very significant days in the Jewish calendar, and we commemorate all three of those days collectively on Asar B'Teves. Now, what took place on these other 2 days? The Shulchan Aruch informs us, and this is also written in the Slichos. If anyone goes to shul on the morning of Asar B'Teves, we recite very special Slichos in the morning. And in there, we tell the story as it relates not only to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, but also to other events as well. What took place as the 9th of Teves? What exactly happened on the 9th of Teves? So we are told, on the 9th of Teves, Ezra HaSofer passed away. The great Ezra passed away. Now, why was Ezra such an important figure? We've had many great tzaddikim who have passed away over the millennia, over the centuries, over the generations, and we don't make a public commemoration for their passing. So what is so special about Ezra HaSofer? Well, there are a number of factors that contribute to the significance of Ezra. Number one, the Gemara tells us, Roy Haya Ezra Shetinasein HaTorah Al Yadu LiYisrael. Ezra was such a great personality that he had the ability to be the one to deliver the Torah from God to the Jewish people. Il Malei Kadma Moshe. If not for the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu came first in history, Ezra would have been the one to give the Torah on Har Sinai. Gives you a little bit of a perspective of who Ezra was. Not only that, the Medrash also tells us, Ilu Haya Aaron Kayam, if Ezra was alive at the time of Moshe and Aaron at the same time period, Haya Ezra Gadol Haymena B'Shaito. Now, I don't know how we judge who's greater than who. I certainly am not one to judge, but the Medrash tells us, if Moshe, Aaron, and Ezra were alive at the time, Ezra would have been greater than Aaron HaKohen. It means he would have been a very close second to Moshe Rabbeinu. So it tells us a little bit about who Ezra was. Not only that, we are told that in the days of Ezra, Kishenishtakha Torah MiYisrael, it was a generation where the Jewish people were not really remembering all of the halachas and all the laws of the Torah as they should have. So we're told, Ala Ezra MiBavel VeYasta. Ezra HaSofer is the one who came and revitalized the Jewish people and taught them once again everything they had to know. It was 70 years in Galus. It was 70 years that the Jewish people were out of their country, out of their land. They were scattered all over the place. Nobody really knew what they were supposed to be doing. Many of the older generation had no longer been alive. And therefore, Ezra HaSofer was the one who was responsible not only for bringing back the Jews to Yerushalayim and building the Beis HaMikdash, but he was also the one responsible for teaching the Jews once again all of the Torah that they needed to know. And this is something that is a very important legacy of Ezra HaSofer. And this is really the reason why Ezra HaSofer was the bridge between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. As we mentioned, Ezra was part of the group of Chagai Zechariah Malachi, the last Nevi'im to live. They end off the Sefer Malachi by saying, Zichru Torah Moshe Avdi. Everybody has to keep the rules of the Torah because there are no longer going to be Nevi'im who are going to tell you what to do. And Eliyahu HaNavi is going to be the next one. Ezra HaSofer tells them that. And therefore, Ezra HaSofer is really the end of the Tanakh. Ezra HaSofer is the end of the period of the Torah Shebichtav as we know it. And from him really was the segue into the era of Torah Shebaalpeh. And therefore, his death was a very significant one in the history of the Jewish people, one which we commemorate on Asar B'Teves as well, because it took place the day before Asar B'Teves. The Shulchan Aruch writes one final factor, and that is, in the days of Malchus Yavan. Yavan was the Greeks. Now, when did that take place? When were they? That was in the second Beis HaMikdash, right? Why do we not have part of Tanakh talking about the story of Hanukkah? Because it was after Tanakh was finished. The story of Hanukkah and Yavan happened after the days of Ezra and all of his contemporaries. So therefore, when Yavan came along, the Gemara tells us the story that they made a Gzeira Kasha, they made a decree that we had to translate the Torah into Yavanis. We had to translate the Torah into other languages. And the Gemara says that day was considered such a catastrophic day for the Jewish people. It was like the Yom Shenasa Bo HaEgel, says the Gemara, was like the day when the Jewish people served Avodah Zarah. And this was something that was a horrible destruction for the Jewish people. Now the question is, why is Art Scroll okay today? It's a real question. And if you look in the earlier volumes of the Art Scroll, those who gave haskamas to the Art Scroll being printed actually raised this question. I don't remember if it was Rav Huttner or of Moshe Feinstein, but one of the letters in the front addresses this question. If the Gemara tells us that it was such a horrible tragedy that the Torah was translated, then what right do we have today to translate the Torah into the languages that we do? So that's a very important question, but the Gemara says, Yarda Choshech Liolam Shlosha Yamim, as a result of this terrible decree when the Torah was translated, there was a darkness that set into the world, and that all took place on the eighth day of Teves. So we have 3 days in a row. Ches, the eighth day of Teves, was the day in which the Torah was translated into Greek. The ninth day of Teves was the day in which Ezra HaSofer was, he died. And the tenth day of Teves, as we know, was the day in which Nebuchadnezzar came and laid the siege around Yerushalayim, which really, as the Achronim say, was the beginning of the end. That really was what precipitated the Churban Beis Hamikdash, and therefore that's something worthy of our commemoration. So we spoke a little bit about Asar B'Teves and how important a day it is for us to think about what we're missing, what we're lacking, what we so much look forward to, and what we want in the Binyan Beis Hamikdash. It should be the will that this year Asar B'Teves should be like the Navi Zechariah says, L'yamim tovim, l'sasun, l'simcha. We have a chance still to celebrate the same way they did in the Bayis Sheni, we should be able to do in the Bayis HaShlishi. But if not, if we don't have a Beis Hamikdash, at least we know a little bit more about the background of what Asar B'Teves is really meant to be all about.